Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Well, we're coming up on the first Monday in October when the Supreme Court begins its new term. This time there will be three women in the black robes as Elena Kagan joins the court. Joining me to talk about the upcoming term and some of the cases the court has agreed to hear is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com. Welcome back to the show, Dahlia.
Hi there, Brian.
So Elena Kagan is joining the court, and as I said, there will be three women serving for the first time. But I gather she's not going to be around much this term, is she?
Because she was the Solicitor General in the Obama administration. That means she was the lawyer for the government who argued cases, and she oversaw all the briefing in cases and, you know, all these appeals that come up. If she worked on them according to the ethical rules, and if she participated as a lawyer, then she cannot hear them. And so she has now recused herself from 25 of the 54 cases
Wow.
on which the court has agreed to hear argument. This isn't unprecedented, by the way. We just haven't had a former Solicitor General elevated to the bench in a while. But when Thurgood Marshall was elevated from Solicitor General, he had exactly the same problem his first year.
That's about half the cases. And that leaves the court with an even eight justices to decide many of these cases. What happens in the event of a tie in the Supreme Court?
Oh, well, if they tie, then the lower court ruling is affirmed and no opinion from the Supreme Court issues. So it's the sort of legal effect is nothing. And it's a huge problem. I mean, it's something that a lot of folks who are watching the court are worrying about because she's not only recused from 25 cases, but from important cases.
And since her recusal would leave the case one vote more conservative, Senator Leahy is proposing legislation that would allow retired justices to substitute when there's a recusal. That's allowed in lower courts, apparently, but not on the Supreme Court. Is there any chance that would pass and affect this term?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Senator Leahy says this is a suggestion that John Paul Stevens made to him last spring, that maybe we should think about pulling Souter and O'Connor and me, Justice Stevens, out of retirement to hear some of these cases. And as you say, it's done. 39 of the state courts allow justices to sort of come out of retirement to do this. But as you say, the politics of this are so fraught. Really, do you think that Republicans who can't even confirm Obama's moderate judges would ever allow a Stevens or a Souter, and they actually probably would say a wild card like O'Connor to come be that ninth vote?
I wonder what the politics of that would be. I mean, they're so against filibustering a Supreme Court nominee. Could they filibuster a sitting Supreme Court justice, somebody who's been on the court for, you know, decades?
I think they would just say that Leahy's entire piece of legislation is just completely untenable and, you know, we can't even contemplate this. But I do think that if these were three very, very conservative judges we were talking about coming off the bench, we might be having a different conversation.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate about the upcoming Supreme Court term, which begins on Monday. And if you have any questions, this is just going to be a few more minutes, but if you have any thoughts about this upcoming Supreme Court term or its makeup, 212-433-WNYC. For Dahlia Lithwick, 212-433-9692, and we'll get you right on. As for the most anticipated cases, I see a couple of First Amendment cases. One is Snyder versus Phelps, which is going to come right up next Wednesday. Phelps is the extremely anti-gay pastor from Topeka, Kansas, who disrupts military funerals. Yikes. What's behind this case in a constitutional sense?
Well, this is this awful, awful case that forces those of us who are rabid First Amendment zealots to really ask ourselves how zealous we really are. This is the Westboro Baptist Church. These guys seem to have convinced themselves that the reason we lose wars is because God hates gay people. And so Matthew Snyder was killed in Iraq in 2006. And he's one of many, many people, by the way, not a gay soldier, just a soldier that the Westboro Church came and picketed his funeral. This is a really messy case, Brian. I mean, the facts are terrible. It's not clear. His father sued for all sorts of emotional anguish, but it's not clear that his father saw the protesters. There was stuff that went up on the Westboro Church's website that was really awful, so there's a whole other question about whether this is the funeral picketing that's at issue or the postings on the web. But in effect, what happened was that they were awarded a massive, massive $5 million award, and the Fourth Circuit overturned it and said, no, what Westboro Church is doing at these funerals, even though they come to private funerals and they stand there with their signs that say God hates fags and really disgrace the decorum, that this is protected free speech. And so the core issue that the court has to grapple with is, you know, what kind of protest is political? What kind of space is private? Are the zoning requirements that keep you from the immediate vicinity of the funeral enough? But as I say, this case is a huge, huge mess procedurally. And the question most of us are asking is, why did the court take it?
Another First Amendment case has to do with violent video games. California has a law prohibiting the sale of certain violent games to minors. So is this a question of, you know, social censoriousness versus free enterprise?
Well, it's certainly a case where the makers of these violent video games, the ban is essentially says these games cannot be sold or rented to minors, and they're quite explicit. They say, look, these are games that involve hacking people up and dismembering people. They're clear about what they say is violence. Six other states, by the way, Brian, have similar laws, so it's not just California that's at issue. But I think that the makers of these video games say, look, this isn't a class of speech that we protect minors from. I mean, in 1968, the Supreme Court said, okay, we can keep obscene speech from minors, but this isn't obscene. This is just violent. And really, Supreme Court, are you going to create another class of unprotected speech? And really, I think what it comes down to, and the filmmakers have weighed in on this, is there's a real question, and this was why the Ninth Circuit struck down the law, there's a real question about whether this causes harm to minors, whether it makes minors more violent. So there's a question here about, look, is this just speech you don't like? Can you prove to us that this is speech that's harmful? And I think that's one of the issues we're going to have to think about.
Will the Supreme Court be challenged to defend its current position that sexual speech is somehow more damaging to minors than violent speech?
I think it will. And if you recall, one of the big blockbuster Supreme Court cases, we're in an era of sort of hot free speech cases at the court. And one of the interesting ones that came down last year was a case where Congress tried to do away with, you'll recall, these crush videos with women who would wear high heels and stomp on little baby chicks, and it was some kind of weird sexual fetish. And Congress tried to ban that, and the court was very, very clear. We're not creating whole new classes of unprotected speech. We just don't do that. We haven't done that in decades. So I think you're right. I think this is really a question of, is the court going to carve out an entire category of speech, even just as regards to minor, that the court says is unprotected? And this court is not really all that inclined to do that.
Listeners, we're speaking with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate.com, previewing the new Supreme Court term, which begins on Monday. We're going to spend the last 3 or 4 minutes of this hour taking your calls on the very relevant question, how wet is it? Now that you're swimming in your basements and your street corners, and Dahlia, don't laugh, I'm going to ask you too before you go, because I know this is the case in Washington too. One of the most tropically wet couple of days that we've had in New York in memory. So we're going to ask you to call in, and you can start calling now. We want your answer to the question, how wet is it? Some of you may remember we did similar questions when it was really, really, really cold last winter and really, really, really hot last summer. Now that it's really, really, really wet, we're going to ask, how wet is it? So get your answers ready, and you can start calling in right now and getting in line. How wet is it? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, but we definitely want you on the air for this one. How wet is it? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, for as soon as we're done with Dahlia. All right, so let's go to more of the cases that are slated for this term. There's another case after Citizens United where the personhood of a corporation is in play. In this case, AT&T's competitors wanted to use the Freedom of Information Act to gain access to what could be considered trade secrets, and AT&T is claiming that that violates their right to privacy. So given the outcome of Citizens United, is that the question? Do corporations have the same right to privacy as individuals?
Well, that's really the nut of it, and I think that this was certainly a claim that's emboldened after Citizens United and the idea of corporate personhood. Essentially, this came up as a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act, and FOIA has a provision that says, look, we'll exempt FOIA requests for any records that could result in, quote, an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. Now, the question here is, can AT&T, not a person, say, hey, my personal privacy is at stake? And the Third Circuit, before even Citizens United came down, said, absolutely, personal privacy can include corporations. And, everybody went crazy. All the freedom of access to information, people went crazy and said that means corporations can have a veil of secrecy over everything that they do. And is it really the case that corporations can be, as the Third Circuit argued, embarrassed? Can they be harassed? Can they be stigmatized because of their secrets? And so it is a sort of interesting follow-on to Citizens United about, well, if corporations have free speech rights, I guess they could be embarrassed too.
They are allowed to have trade secrets, though, under the law already, without personhood, that they're supposed to be allowed to keep from their competitors, aren't they?
They are, but I think the question in this case was whether they were going to be embarrassed and harassed.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very, very different set of issues. I don't think it's so much about trade secrets as it is we're going to look really stupid.
There's also a pair of cases hinging on religious rights. Arizona Christian School Tuition Organization versus Wynn and Sossaman versus Texas. Give us, in a nutshell, what's at stake in those cases.
Well, it's interesting. As you recall, there were some interesting religion cases last term. Arizona Christian School tuition really is another question of whether an Arizona law that gives tax breaks to people who make donations to private scholarships, including scholarship funds that go to religious schools, whether that's unconstitutional because it's channeling taxpayer money into religious schools. It looks an awful lot, Brian, like a voucher program that the court already upheld in 2002. So a lot of folks think this is just another case that the court is taking to slap down the Ninth Circuit. The other one is just a prisoner case where a Texas prisoner wanted to be able to use the prison chapel for prayer. He wasn't able to access it. He had to pray somewhere else. And he's filing a petition that's essentially saying, look, I need to pray in the chapel because, hey, there's a cross in there. So I think it becomes a very interesting case because, mm-hmm. as you'll recall, one of the interesting religion cases last year was that big old cross in the Mojave Desert. 5 out of the 4 justices said, well, that cross is permissible for all sorts of reasons, but 4 out of the 4 justices said crosses aren't really Christian symbols.
One last thing real quick. Justice Breyer has a new book. We're trying to get him for the show because he's actually going to be a Supreme Court justice on a bit of a book tour in which he attacks, or we think he is, in which he attacks originalism. Has Justice Scalia, the adherent to originalism, responded?
He hasn't responded, and Breyer's book is a really lovely attack on originalism that at no point names Scalia. Breyer's book is a very, very interesting book. It's written for the lay public. I absolutely commend it to your listeners. And he's trying essentially to say, look, the Supreme Court preserves its legitimacy not because we are weird oracles who talk to the framers, but because you, the public, engage with us constantly in this back and forth about what the Constitution means, and we engage with other other parts of the government, be it the states or the Congress or other courts, that it's this back and forth that keeps constitutional interpretation alive. In effect, what I think he's saying is it's not that we're activists. What we are is always in conversation, and that's so much more important than being an originalist. It's a really interesting book. I can't recommend it enough.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com, who covers the Supreme Court. New term starts Monday. Dahlia, thank you very much for joining us.